Just isn't right to say anything after that, except to thank the children and our deep, profound thanks to the teachers and the staff who helped them to put it on. There has always been a high point to this evening. And in spite of all the wonderful things we've done up to now, I think we are still in where the experience of the thrill of recognizing still another book in the growing library of books that our children need, and books which we hope our grandchildren and their children will learn to live with instead of some of the things that we grew up with, so that the caricature that we accepted until we learned better will not be the heritage that our children will pass on, but rather that they will pass on a truer picture of this country and the things that make our country the kind of place that Mr. Horn talked about before that it could be, the kind of country that will develop more of what we saw tonight. For this part of the evening, I would like to turn the chair over to Mrs. Wolf, who has done this before. She is no stranger to this award giving. She is no stranger to the school. She is no stranger, I'm sure, to all of you.
We go from high to high. I don't know where we'll end. Before we talk about the award tonight, I think most of you know what the Nancy Block Award is. For those of you who are new to this school, I think you might want to hear the way the award got started. Nancy Block was a student at Downtown Community. When she died at the age of 13, there were many of the parents at the school and friends of the school who looked for an appropriate memorial. Monuments are deadly, but living books are not, and it seemed most appropriate that Nancy Block be remembered through an intercultural library and an award for the best book in intergroup relations each year. We have quite a setup for the award. I think you might want to know the way it worked this year. We have three judges. In addition to myself, Mrs. Eva Epstein, will you rise, please, of Columbia Library, and Professor Embler of Cooper, who helped in the selection. Before the judges got the book, there was a sifting process. The books were distributed to parents who read and made judgments based on certain criteria that had been set up. And to the many parents who read the very many books that came in this year, we want to express our thanks. We want to thank particularly Mrs. Rhoda Bellack, who is sitting here, who did a lot of the trafficking of getting the books distributed and read. And we think she owes us, we owe her a special vote of thanks. There's a new spirit that's alive in the land today, and it seems that it took the youngsters to shame some of us into this spirit. The demonstration in the South, the sit-in demonstrations, are a very lively and exciting ray of hope. Somehow it seems to me particularly appropriate that the award this year should go to sort of a younger sister of these students. The book Mary Jane by Dorothy Sterling is a story about a young Negro girl who faces her first problems in going to a newly integrated school in the South. Dorothy Sterling has brought to the book an insight and a compassion that is truly rare. When the judges were choosing a book, we had a rather happy problem. There were very many good books submitted this year by the parents, but there was none that had the unanimous vote of all three judges. 1959 was a particularly good year in the field of intergroup relations in books. Many books about American Indians, I think, demonstrate that the problems of this persecuted minority are far from solved. The enormous number of books coming out about Japan, Africa, Asia, demonstrates to us, I think, that these countries are becoming increasingly more important in our world. There are very many historical books being written for children, particularly about the Civil War. And this, I think, is an indication that writers and editors are troubled by the present Southern conflict. But very few of them really hit the problem head on. Children's writers resist writing about the here and now, particularly when this here and now is difficult and painful. But this Dorothy Sterling has done. And she has done it in such a unique and beautiful way that it is a story not merely for young children, but I think for all of us. I read it with as much excitement as I read any adult book. And to Dorothy Sterling, of course, we express our thanks and our hopes that she will continue to write in this field. Before presenting the award, I want to make special mention of the publisher, Doubleday, who I think deserves some very special gratitude for keeping alive this kind of interest. And I want to thank, too, the artist of this book, Ernest Prichlow, who is here. I think Mr. Prichlow... Mr. Prichlow is an artist of repute, but he makes each of the books a real work of art. And someday I hope we will have an award for the best illustrator of children's books, and I'm sure that my vote will go for Ernest Prichlow. Dorothy Sterling is winning the Nancy Block Award 2 years running, and this is rather unique. But I think it is a tribute to the kind of devotion she has to her craft and to the subjects that she chooses. Last year, she won the award for Captain of the Planter, a book about a historical novel about Captain Smalls. And I think we should mention, too, that one of the recommended books several years ago was her Freedom Train, the story of Harriet Tubman. Would you come up, Mrs. Sterling? And we are... to give you, in the name of the judges and the Nancy Block Library, this plaque You're making a collection of them, I know. And this check, which is just a small token of our thanks and our hope that you'll continue to light up some of the darker paths that children have to travel.
Well, thank you so much. It's a great honor to win the Nancy Block Award, but I feel that the honor belongs to Mary Jane. It's true, I wrote a story about two girls and a squirrel and a biology teacher, but I didn't invent the character Mary Jane. I met her in the South. There are hundreds of Mary Janes. I made a trip through the South a few years ago with a photographer, and we did an adult book, which we called Tender Warriors, because we felt so impressed by the bravery of these children who were going to school against such odds. I'm reading the papers these days, I think I'd like to write some sequels, you know, like the party stories of Mary Jane sits in and Woolworths and Mary Jane sits outside the house up in Alabama. Aren't those kids wonderful?
Soon we will invite you to have coffee and cake. But before we leave this room, I'd like to remind you of tomorrow's program, which begins at 1 o'clock. We will have a principal speaker for the early part of the morning, Dr. Hans Treyfus. And then for the latter part of the day, we will have the panel. I hope you have this. I don't want to take the time now to read you the names of the people on the panel, but it will be a working panel. For those of you who are interested in what materials we have available, for those of you who want this kind of material that you saw tonight available in this school and in all schools and in the public schools, for those of you who are concerned about where to get what is here and what to do about the materials we have still to develop, this will be a very important day for you. I'd like to invite everyone here to attend tomorrow. And if you know of people in the community who were not able to come tonight but who would like to sit in on tomorrow's meetings, please invite them to come along with you. And now, we will have coffee and refreshments downstairs. Will those of us who are within the family take those of us who are visitors downstairs? It's not easy to get to.
This is the end of the Friday evening, March 18th, 1960. Intergroup conference at Downtown Community School, New York City. The balance of this session will take place tomorrow. It's Saturday, March 19th, 1960 at Downtown Community School, for the second half of the fourth annual conference on intergroup education. The speakers today will consist of Chairman Norman Studer, Director of Downtown Community School, Dr. Hans Treyfus, Assistant Professor of History, Brooklyn College, Sylvia Applebaum, President of Pilot Publishing Company, Una Buxenbaum, Teacher at Downtown Community School, Mosel Clarence Hill, Professor of Education, Teachers College, Columbia University, Olivia Hollis, Teacher, PS2, Eve Merriam, Bank Street College Writers Laboratory, Jules Schwerin, President, Folk Films. See, that's no good. Oh, yes, that's all right.
On intergroup education. This afternoon session is all of one piece. Although on the program it may look otherwise. We are interested in the large subject of producing materials for intergroup education. We are going to have a speaker on the reconstruction period and the implications for revision of prevailing attitudes in regard to that, and then we're going to have a discussion of materials in general. This will all fit together, and you will see how later. But in the meantime, before we begin, I would like to introduce the people who are sitting up here so you know who we are. At my left is Mrs. Hollis, who is a teacher at PS2.
In the Bronx,
I'm sorry, and a parent at Downtown Community School. Mrs. Sylvia Applebaum, president of Pilot Publishing Company. Eve Merriam of the Bank Street Writers Laboratory. Professor Trefus, assistant professor of history at Brooklyn College. Dr. James Hill, who is in charge of community in charge of district school community coordination. He also was part of a committee which set up the in-service courses in intergroup education for the public schools of New York City, and he gives the course in his district. And Mrs. Buxenbaum, teacher of the 8th grade, 7th and 8th grade in social studies and English at Downtown Community School, and author of a book as yet unpublished on Sojourner Truth. We still, I think that I saw him arrive, Red Thundercloud, would you come join our panel? And is Mr. Schwerin here? You sit over here. We like to feel that Red Thundercloud is part of our staff here at Downtown Community School. He comes to us each year, and his concern is materials for presenting a correct picture of the American Indian. And then also we will have Mr. Jules Schwerin, president of Folk Films, and I assume he will arrive a bit later. In the heat of oratory last night, I gave my introduction to this meeting. So those of you who are there, please excuse me if I am repetitious, because I think that the things that I said belong to this meeting. I began by talking about an assembly program that we had here at school yesterday morning, in which some 15 or 16 students of the 6th, 7th, and 8th grades reported on a number of books published in 1959 which dealt with intergroup relations of some kind. How these youngsters reported for an hour and to an audience ranging from 3rd to 8th grade, and how everybody listened very attentively for that whole period to a very interesting discussion. Now, this could only happen because of the fact that in the field of children's books, we are beginning to get a literature that reflects the whole of our American culture. And it seems to me that this is the most important way of looking at this whole question of intergroup materials for intergroup education. That our job essentially is to give to our children the whole of the American heritage. We have not got that up to now. Because our American experience is an intergroup experience. Our country from the very beginning was a country of various groups. In Washington's army, there were German-speaking people. They say more who spoke German than spoke English. All the way through, New York City, any part of our country, you touch it, you find an intergroup experience. We have not begun as yet to reflect that in what we transmit to our children. Some 10 or 15 years ago, when intergroup education became important throughout the country, we talked about the contributions method of intergroup education, where you talked about the contributions of various groups to our culture, as though each minority group brought in a little basket. Here it is. This entitles me to admission to the party. And we now find that reflected 10 or 15 years later in some of the newer textbooks, where you have a little paragraph on the fact that the Indians left us the names of many places, or the Indians contributed tobacco, or something like that. Well, this was important, and this is a beginning, and this is symbolic, but it is not the whole thing. We will not do the adequate thing until our children get, on the level of their understanding, the gist of the intergroup experience of the collision of the two cultures, the white European people and the Indian. Until we know that, that the Indian had a tradition that had dignity and importance, and that there was a conflict there, but there also was interchange, a wonderful interchange. And there's an interesting theme that never has been really developed in American history of the people on the frontier who went over the line and joined the Indian culture and became, in effect, Indians. And there are great Americans that we know nothing about. Here in New York State, how many people know about Joseph Brant, an Indian who was rooted in his Indian culture, but also was educated in Europe, and who came to be a great statesman of the Indian people. So there is this whole, just as an example, this Indian experience. And then this contributions theory told us that the Negro people should be respected because there was a Dr. Carver, and he did a lot of things with peanuts. Well, I don't mean any disrespect to a great man and his accomplishments, but too many white educators have been salving their conscience too long with Negro History Week programs dealing with Dr. Carver and Marian Anderson. This again is a beginning. This is symbolic, and this was important, but it is only a beginning, and our children will need to know the whole of the intergroup experience of the Negro people and the white people, the Negro people and the Indian people. This is another relationship, intergroup relationship. But all of this is part of our heritage. There's been a great deal of talk about changing the image of the ugly American abroad. the picture of the American that is abroad as a shallow person devoted to fintails, refrigerators, and TV sets. The picture reflected in this year's Oxford University debate resolved that this House holds America responsible for spreading vulgarity in Western society is not the triviality of much of our American culture due to the fact that we have not given our young people this heritage, this true heritage of America. We talked about the Korean soldiers who could not hold to their beliefs because there was no core of any belief there. Well, a large part of this whole core is the whole experience of these various peoples here in America. And the most important place to begin to change the image of America abroad is to change the image of our country in our own children's minds, that they will get the whole of the American intergroup experience, that they will get this whole golden thread of that runs through American history, of the people who worked for a respect and an understanding and a crossing of group lines and a mutual learning from each other and appreciating each other that runs through American history. You could name names in all fields: Thomas Jefferson, Walt Whitman, Frederick Douglass, Sojourner Truth, a great number of people. Until we give our children this true image of America, we will not have a very respectable image abroad. And this is the America. This is America. And we must not deprive our children of this America. So that instead of thinking, as educators do when they think of a chapter in a textbook on the roots of American culture, they don't think of Europe alone and Greece and Rome. But that people will automatically think of Africa. In my country, as a citizen of a country of many cultures, Africa is my tradition as a white American as much as it is the tradition of the Negro American. And Europe is the tradition of the Negro American, and Africa is the tradition of the Negro American. And until we begin to feel this oneness in our culture, we will there will be something lacking. And then we will have an American who lives in harmony with his own culture, who feels good about his own family group, his culture group, his religious group, but also identifies with other Americans who are also Americans and citizens who have another cultural origin. And this sort of dual approach of being very much secure in what you are, but not chauvinistic, but also being able to understand people in other groups, which is the formula for America, can also be the formula for citizens of the world, because it's the same pattern, the same kind of personality that we're trying to develop that will be important for world living as well as living at peace within America. With this introduction, I think you will see how everything that we're going to do fits together. To create such a culture is not the job of the teacher. The teacher cannot do it alone. Heroic teachers in hours between 11 and 2 at night can write textbooks and write storybooks, and this is wonderful. But we need storytellers, we need historians, we need filmmakers, we need everybody who's concerned with the currents and development of our culture to be interested in this, and that's why this panel today is the very panel that it is. So I'd like now to introduce Professor Trefus, who is a scholar, who is author of a book on a very much maligned general, Ben Butler. The subtitle of his Life of Ben Butler is The South Called Him Beast, and because the South called him Beast, the North calls him Beast too. And he's now working on the life of a radical Republican congressman from Ohio, Ben Wade. I'm very happy to have Professor Trefus with us.
Mr. Chairman, fellow panelists, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, thank you very much for the introduction. And I think what you said about Ben Butler is so very true, because the South called him Beast, the North called him Beast too. That, in fact, has been the chief trouble with our view of the Civil War and Reconstruction, and today I'm going to speak especially on Reconstruction, for the past 30 or 40 years. Somehow or other, the South may have lost the war, but it certainly won it in the history books, and in many of the history books, and most certainly won it in the Westerns, whenever you turn on television set. And you see a Western, you will find that the villain is always the Union veteran, and the hero is always the Confederate veteran. Moreover, our children walk around with Confederate forage caps and with Confederate flags, and they do sell some Union forage caps also, I think, but I've never seen them on a child. And certainly American flags are not generally seen in the same way that you carry around Confederate flags, which all of which goes to show that somehow or other the South managed to win, historically speaking. Now, this is especially true of Reconstruction. For years, the very word Reconstruction has conjured up in the minds of people, a poor, downtrodden people that was honorably defeated in war, laid down its arms, and had no other wish but to come back into the Union and to love its fellow men. And it was abused and maltreated by these wicked radicals in the North who forced the South to subject to rule more horrible than anything the world had ever seen before. A travesty of government. That is the old stereotype. Now, this old stereotype was fostered very much by a group of historians who were headed by a gentleman of Columbia called Dunning. Professor Dunning wrote a book on Reconstruction in which he set forth this general view that I have briefly alluded to, and unfortunately, it seems to me, set loose upon this country a flood of graduate students, all of whom went on and wrote the same sort of thing that he wrote. Now, the key to the whole story, to Mr. Dunning's whole story, is that the word Negro was never once spelled with a capital N. Now, I know this was customary in those days, but in his case, this small N had a very definite meaning. Whereas all other races and peoples and ethnic groups could be spelled with a capital letter, not so the Negro. And this really, in many ways, accounted for much of what it was in the books. Now, Mr. Dunning was followed by Mr. George Fort Milton, who wrote The Age of Hate, and Mr. Claude Bowers, who wrote The Tragic Era, all of them spelled Negro with a small N, of Mr. Fleming, who wrote Sequel to Appomattox. It was a smaller book but had the same stuff in it. Lloyd Paul Stryker, who was a New York lawyer, a Republican, who wrote a biography of Andrew Johnson and became so enamored of Andrew Johnson that he changed his party affiliation and voted Democratic in 1928, when this was not really the gentlemanly thing to do in New York. Since then, any number of people have written about the individual states and have written the same thing. Now, since that time, it's become customary to spell, at least spell Negro with a capital N. And you have now, you might say, a sort of uptown edition of this stunning school, which is represented by Mr. Coulter, who is a southerner and wrote and edits a, has edited a long series of books called History of the South. Now, he wrote the volume for Reconstruction. And this is really a sort of up-to-date version of Mr. Dunning. You will find there, to be sure, a Negro has a capital N, and the book doesn't say that in so many words that the whites are naturally superior to the Negroes. But if you read the book, there's really no doubt in your mind that that's really what he has in mind, except with a little circumlocution so you can sell the book up north without having too much of a row. In some ways, it's much more vicious than the open and avowed anti-Negro stories that used to come out years ago. And only last year, a final book on Reconstruction apparently was published by this school by Mr. Harding Carter, who in many ways is much fairer than his predecessors, but who still in many ways suffers from some of the prejudices. Well, how can a man living in Mississippi suffer from anything but prejudices if he's on one side, and anything suffer from anything but repression if he lives on the other? So that has been the school. Now, I see that on this program I'm supposed to speak of a new look at the Reconstruction period, and I'm very sad indeed that my talk has to be entitled that, because the new look of Reconstruction is now 30 years old, which is exactly a generation. And you might say was really the ball was started rolling when Mr. Du Bois wrote his famous Black Reconstruction. Now that book appeared in the early 1930s, almost 30 years ago. It proved beyond any doubt that this old school was all wrong. It proved that this old picture of Africanization and misrule and corruption and suffering white people in the South and wicked carpetbaggers and scalawags and vindictives was nothing but a myth and a fairy tale in many cases. As a matter of fact, as Mr. Du Bois proved almost 30 years ago, and as I think virtually everyone who has looked at this since with an unprejudiced point of view has agreed, well, first of all, there was no such thing as Black Reconstruction, for the simple reason that except in two southern states, South Carolina and Louisiana, the Negroes were not even in the majority in the state legislatures. In Louisiana, that was evenly divided. And even if they were in a majority in South Carolina, the show was really run by their white allies. So the story of Black Reconstruction is misleading. And as far as the corruption is concerned, well, as Mr. Du Bois pointed out so well, corruption in 1868, 69, 1870, must you go to the South for that? Was there not in New York City a man called William Marcy Tweed who, in the short period of 3 years, stole $20 million from the city treasury at a time when $20 million was as much as it really sounds and not just a drop in the bucket as it is today? There is a building behind City Hall down here called the City Court. It's not a beautiful building by any means. It was put up by Boss Tweed for four times the amount that it cost to build. Now, the taxpayer had to pay for all this. And, of course, the difference all went into the pockets of Mr. Tweed and his allies. But that wasn't all. In various western states, the state officers were jailed for selling franchises. Others gambled away the agrarian funds. The legislature in Albany could be openly bought and sold. The same was true of the legislature in Harrisburg. And corruption was so widespread in the North that Mr. Dunning himself refers to the second Grant administration as the nadir of national disgrace. stressing these corrupt carryings on in the North. Well now, if corruption is so widespread, obviously it is utterly silly to blame Reconstruction for corruption. Let's go one step further. As Mr. Du Bois also showed very well, the story of the Southern poor Southerners who wanted nothing so much as to live in peace with their former enemies and be readmitted to the Union, and who were thus therefore woefully abused, is utterly wrong too. Why? Well, after all, after 4 years of war, you can't really expect that the victorious power will at least demand some sort of compliance with its wishes. But what were the facts? Never in the history of civil war, it seems to me, has a defeated section gotten away so easily as did the South. Let us assume for just a moment that Fidel Castro had captured Batista. Do you really think that Batista would have been allowed to head the University of Havana? And was not, after all, General Lee permitted to become the president of Washington University in Lexington, Virginia? Think of it for a moment. Or do you really think that if General Franco had ever captured Juan Negrin, he would have allowed him to publish his memoirs and live on for 40 years as an unreconstructed opponent of the regime? Well, that's what happened. Jefferson Davis lived on for years, and except for 2 years of imprisonment, nothing much happened to him. I hate to think what would happen to Chiang Kai-shek should he ever fall into the hands of Mao Zedong. I do know that he will not have time to write his memoirs. Now, under these circumstances, it seems to me that this downtrodden South wasn't so downtrodden at all. Indeed, at the very beginning, the South, under the Johnson Plan in 1865, was permitted to come right back into the Union after merely abolishing slavery on paper and repealing the secession ordinances and abolishing the Confederate debt. And then what happened? Black codes were enacted in various southern states, which virtually put the Negro back under conditions of slavery. And if that weren't enough, as senator from Georgia, there was elected none other than Alexander Stevens, late vice president of the Confederacy. Well, I suggest to you that if Hermann Göring had appeared at the United Nations in 1945 as the representative of a new Germany, it would have had the same effect under those circumstances. Again, the South was not very wise after the war, and it is not at all surprising that a different sort of regime was set up. But this different sort of regime, after all, merely carried out certain democratic premises, namely, you must allow people to vote and to govern themselves. And in view of the fact that, according to some of us, even back in 1866, Negroes were people too, therefore obviously they had a right to take part in their own government. Now this, of course, is more than many of these Southerners could accept. But as the record shows, corrupt as some of these legislatures were, virtually all legislatures in those days were corrupt, nevertheless they achieved any number of lasting reforms. They wrote constitutions which the Southerners kept long after the Reconstruction elements had been thrown out. They established free public education for the first time in the South. They established charitable institutions, abolished imprisonment for debt, and instituted a system of taxation which fell heavily upon the rich and more lightly on the poor. For this they were blamed, but any modern economist will tell you that that is exactly the test of a good tax. But all these things were pointed out to us many years ago. Since that time, any number of other writers, such as Mr. David Donald, and Mr. Simpkins, and Professor John Hope Franklin, and more recently Fawn Brody, who has written a book on Thaddeus Stevens, have pointed out these things. But what do we find? We find that in reality, very little of this has made a general impression, and there are still many textbooks in use throughout this country in which you find the old stereotype view of Dunning. And you will find, for example, that a high school text such as Canfield and Wilder still speaks of the terrible sufferings of the South, has a whole chapter heading with that title. You find that a historian as renowned as Mr. Bailey, a diplomatic historian, in his text, one volume text for college students called Pageant of American History, gives the old unadulterated Dunning point of view. And so it seems to me that what is really needed here is a very thorough re-examination of some of the texts we use, and if we rewrite them, a reading of books as old by this time as Black Reconstruction by Mr. Du Bois. Now, it seems to me if we do that, then we can make progress, and any number of new books have come out which have given attention to some of these new, in quotation marks, findings. And I believe this is a very hopeful sign, and I do hope that as time goes on, some of these facts which have been pointed out for so long will finally find their way into the history books, and this will be a happier country for all. Thank you.
One of the things that has livened our conference this year, last night a seventh grade from our school, today a committee from the Elizabeth Irwin High School, eighth grade, with their exhibit on the Reconstruction period, their teacher Murray Lewis, their director Dr. Smith, and I'm sure some of their parents in the audience. There are other teachers here also from Elizabeth Irwin and Little Red Schoolhouse. We want to welcome you here and invite you to take part in the discussion. It certainly is encouraging to hear from a scholar who has convictions and a moral sense about social matters. I'll tell you, when I open up the New York Times every Sunday and find reviews of 10 books weeping about the old South and the gentlemanly virtues that are departed, and especially when I saw that TV review of last year with the Little Rock racists marching down the street with an American flag and a Confederate flag, it certainly makes you feel that something should be done. We invite you now to questions or comments. Yes?
I would like to make two references. One is September, Labor Day of last year. I was in Alexandria, Virginia. The whole town was plastered up with Confederate flags. The hotel had notice of special Confederate meals to be served. Another reference, recently I saw a new film which is called The Background of the Civil War. After the film, several people from the South said, that film is not acceptable. And the question was asked, why? Because you say the background of a civil war. There was no such thing as a civil war. There was a war between the states. So the South are still reveling in the fact that there were rebels.
Yes.
Recently, I've
anti-Semitism and the desecration of the houses of worship, the New York Post did, I think, 2 articles on the textbooks in New York public schools. They were making a spot check of the treatment of modern Germany. And we thought it would be helpful if they could be urged to make, at this time, a spot check of the treatment of the Negro in public school textbooks, since the air seems to be fraught with a discussion of textbooks not only in the public schools but also religious texts.
Yes?
I was wondering, how are textbooks written? I mean, who chooses the authors? Is it a publishing house? Is it done in conjunction with schools? I really don't know. Where is the pressure put on? How can...
Dr. Allen, could you take that question?
Yes. Textbooks. Are compiled into a directory that are placed on a list that is called the approved list for textbooks for use in the public schools in New York City. Under the jurisdiction of the associate superintendent in charge of curriculum, who happens to be Miss Ethel Huggard, a committee is appointed each year to review textbooks and who recommend to the curriculum committee the acceptance or the rejection of a textbook, and then it passes on from Ms. Huggett's office to the Board of Superintendents, who approve it, and it goes on the approved list. It's necessary oftentimes when these books are published to register protests with the Board of Education, certainly through the department, the curriculum, through Ms. Huggett's department, so that perhaps special attention is given. Now, I don't know how carefully these books are scrutinized. They give them to members of the committee, and I suppose if it's a volume like your two volumes or something like that, I suppose they go through pretty rapidly. Anyway, every citizen has the right to make the complaint, and many corrections have taken place, or a number of books have been taken from the shelves, particularly of the libraries. Oh, by the way, too, while I'm thinking about it, in the library setup, a similar situation prevails. Another committee under the auspices of the director of the libraries has something to do with the selection of books for the library. And sometimes there are books in the library that are not on the approved list, and sometimes there are books on the approved list that perhaps are not in the on the library shelves. But it's necessary to have the sanction of the board before any book is permitted for use in the schools. And certainly citizens can play a very important part in their looking through new texts that come out from the press and reporting their reactions, because that division welcomes that kind of criticism.
Mrs. Lee.
In this connection with the choice of textbooks, I wonder if anyone knows what the role of a publisher is in this selection. I got the impression from Dr. Hill that this committee of which you spoke, on the Board of Education of which you spoke, concerns itself with that material which is already published. But am I mistaken in my impression that some publishing houses actually commission the writing of textbooks? And if that's the case, don't they have an influence on what finally appears as a textbook?
I can only speak perhaps for some of my experiences with the Board of Education. And by the way, this reminds me of what they call the model husband, small imitation of the real thing. I'm the small imitation of the real thing, because Dr. Hill is not here today. My name is Alan. And he's a good friend of mine, and he came to see me the other night and begged that I come down here for this. He didn't have to do that because I was anxious to get a chance to meet some of the parents in this area. I know a goodly number of them. But in the matter of publishing, you know, for a long time, a lot of the books that were used in the schools, public schools, were written by people pretty closely connected with the Board of Education, superintendents and principals and so forth. One of the ways to get fame and reputation was to write a textbook. Gordy's History, some of you might remember that was used in the public schools in New York for a long time, and Scotland's History and so forth on down the line. Rabbi Norton was the superintendent. He wrote a series of geographies. And, of course, a big sale in New York because you got a million children. And, of course, if you get your book on the approved text list and you know a number of good principals and so forth, you're sure to get pretty good sales. Publishers, and I don't want to get into that field because some people here who know perhaps more about that than I do, but I do know this, because there are very frequently when salesmen come into my office to talk about books or to get my approval of a book or something of the kind, they will perhaps spill out the story. It may be true, it may not be true, but they'll oftentimes tell you about the fact that the can only print one edition, and it's to be sold in Georgia as well as in New York. And therefore, they're not going to do anything to offend the rebels in Georgia. And then, of course, they will compromise in a way and really distort and commit errors and things of that sort in order to try to please all the people at the same time to sell as many books as they possibly can. And that has been the tendency. Certainly I know two or three publishing houses whose representatives told me that point blank. Now, the school board in New York City came out not so very long ago with a very strong statement condemning the types of publications that oftentimes come out and asking that they give due considerations to the very things that are being brought out here by Mr. Studer in recognizing the contributions of all groups, because we are changing our society picture here, particularly in our metropolitan life, and that the schools, school publishers should take into consideration that fact that there are other people besides the blonde hairs and the blue eyes and so forth, the other people who came up into the puritanical England, New England, and, so forth, and set the pattern for this whole thing, but that other people too had a contribution to make. So the board itself has asked that can be done. But of course the board can't demand or say to a publishing company, you do this, because they don't do their own publishing. They have to depend upon their books from the publishers, but I think that if citizens make enough protest about it, that they can remove these books that are objectionable, or books that do not tell the complete story, and other books substituted that perhaps are much better, both for adults and for children as well.
Propagandizing that we have to watch too. I'd like to make a reference to the fact concerning that Negroes aren't still accepted in the South. When my father was in St. Louis a couple of years ago, he was looking for a place to eat, and in the front window of a restaurant, it had a sign saying, with an arrow pointing to a side door, saying, "Negroes this way." Well, of course, he didn't eat here because, and his other friends did, because they felt that if they couldn't be accepted to go into the front door, they wouldn't go in at all. And concerning the fact of the schools here in New York and the textbooks that we use, I feel that not only the white people should learn of the Rumi and the Reconstruction, but I know my friends that go to schools in Harlem, they don't really learn, I don't think, enough about the real history of the Negro. And I think that they should, because then they can, it would mean that the Negro would be able to help themselves more in the fight for equality.
Do you find books that are printed more in the North still?
Yes.
Do you find books that are sold more in the North? Do you find them still slanted towards the South?
Do I find more books printed in the North that are what?
They're slanted towards the South.
Slanted towards the South? Well, you know, most of the book publishing companies are in the North. They're centered around either New York or Chicago. They're the great centers for publications in this country. And as you know, we have great centers like that, and our whole economic setup, like Hollywood, the movies, around Detroit, your automobiles, and Pittsburgh, your steel, and so forth, and you have your book centers, too. Now, it all depends upon the author. I want to say that there are people, and changes are taking place now dealing with this whole thing. It looks like that I'm going to say some of the things that I had intended to say in the panel, in my panel discussion. But I do want to bring this out, for instance. A number of new books are coming off the press. I got a book the other day written by a man from North Carolina. His name is Richard Bardolph, and it deals with their own Negroes. Written by a man who's a professor at the Women's College in the University of North Carolina. Basil Davidson has just come out with a very excellent book on the Lost Cities of Africa, which is a compilation, perhaps, of many of the anthropological studies that have been brought together, giving new facts with reference to the Lost Cities of Africa. So a number of books are coming out that are worthwhile. The thing is that we want to know what these books are. So far as the slanting is concerned, they're mostly published in the North, and we have publishers both in the South and in the North. I wouldn't say that, I don't want to be unjust to the South, and don't want to be unjust to the North. I think it depends upon the individual who is writing the book, from his background, his training, and his experience. You heard in the previous speech about the effect of Dunning and his influence at Columbia, and all the monographs that came out, in particular from the Southern students who came up because they couldn't get graduate work in the South. They came to Columbia for a graduate work. And so monologue after monologue just piled up like that, all on the Reconstruction period, and all carrying the Dunning background. Because another one of those professors, you know, came right from Tennessee there, where Nathan Bedford Forrest came out, you know, as a Ku Klux leader. He was born right in that section, and he came to Columbia there and worked in that department. So naturally, you know how the thing is going to be slanted in that direction.
Yes. Mr. Allen, do you find that there are many Negro authors running on the Reconstruction era?
Some few. You heard the mention of Dr. John Hope.